Welcome to our podcast, Forgotten Victims, The Forensic Interview.
Forensic interviewing traditionally has been associated with child victims. Over the past decade, there's been an evolution in the field of forensic interviewing where it's being applied to vulnerable victims of all ages, forgotten victims, victims with disabilities, mental health disorders, and older adult populations.
Today, I'm back with Senior Consultant Kate Homan. Hey, Kate.
Hi, I'm glad to be back.
And we are very excited to be joined by Dr. Diana Oram, who is the chair of the Forensic Psychology Department at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University in Arizona. Hi, Diana.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Diana, please tell our listeners about yourself and the work that you're doing at Embry-Riddle University. We're really excited to learn about you today.
Sure. So like you said, I am the chair of our forensic psychology program there. And even though we are a small program, we are an interesting and unique program. And I'll get to that in a second. But my background is I'm a clinical psychologist. And for the beginning of my career, I mostly worked as a clinician. I studied individuals with severe mental illness throughout graduate school. And then I shifted into working with veterans, and part of this was just kind of timing and opportunity. And so I worked with veterans with an active duty with PTSD and other mental health issues for a number of years. And then I got back into teaching. So that's what I'm doing now. I'm an assistant professor there, and I manage our small little program. And we actually collaborate a lot across disciplines with a program that studies global securities and produces a lot of students who want to get into law enforcement and work at three-letter agencies. And then on my end, of course, I get students who want to become forensic psychologists. They want to get into the clinical world in some cases. And so there's a lot of opportunity for us to correct and teach and train students in forensic interviewing and appropriate techniques and just kind of better approaches than what we used in the past, especially with interrogation techniques that are no longer being used and taught, hopefully, certainly not at Embry-Riddle. And so that's kind of what links me into the forensic interviewing piece. And there's kind of an additional component as well. So my population of interest has shifted. I've become very interested in working with individuals with disabilities, vulnerable populations, but especially autistic and neurodivergent people. And so my son is autistic. He's 6.5 years old now. And so that has been a huge inspiration. It's been very motivating. And, you know, when I kind of imagine him in the world and the challenges that he faces, I want to do everything in my power to do to sort of ease that for him and everybody else around him. And so part of that is I developed a training protocol for law enforcement. And so what I do locally in my community here in Yavapai County, Arizona, is I give these 4-hour trainings to anyone and everyone who's interested in law enforcement, but I get first responders, I get nurses, I get all sorts of participants. And I train them in what to do when they encounter people with autism in the course of their work. So I sort of train them in, hey, I know you don't know what to do, and I got some tips for you. And if you try out these, you know, giving them more time, giving them more space, et cetera, you're going to have a better time. You're going to have a better outcome. Because, of course, what I really want at the end of the day is to increase safety for both sides and reduce use of force incidents, misunderstandings, violence, et cetera. So that's that's my training. It's 4 hours, like I said, and I wish I could pack more stuff in there. And so that's part of what I wanted to maybe talk more about today here is, you know, if I had more time, if I could do a training part two, if I had an advanced training and people have asked me to do it, I would really focus on forensic interviewing. And so that's kind of my next endeavor in terms of where I want to take this whole thing.
Well, and that's how we got connected, which has been such a great connection because that's our area of expertise, of course, is forensic interviewing for vulnerable populations. So I think about everything that you shared about yourself, Diana, from, you know, your training and clinical work and all the different populations and age groups that you've worked with. And then your own personal experience with your son as well. And I think about, wow, this is a person who maybe is really seeing where those gaps are. So I hear you talking a lot about the initial response, giving people a little more time, giving people a little more space, how those hands-on tools for law enforcement and other first responders can be really helpful. And then we focus a lot of our work on that, you know, on the forensic interview and moving through that criminal justice process. What about the time in between? How can we make sure that people are getting the things that they need between that initial response and maybe getting some sort of appointment for an interview and the next steps that follow that?
Yeah, that is a time that worries me because there is, and there's a fancy intercept model to explain all this, but I think we all know in basic terms what happens. You have an interaction with the criminal justice system. At that point, it's kind of determined, are you a victim? Are you a suspect? Like, which lane are you going to head off into? And so a lot of people in our population, unfortunately, are going to be victims. The numbers say that. There's no disputing those stats, unfortunately, and that's how things tend to go. Oftentimes, unfortunately, they have characteristics that make them, it sounds awful, but good victims, right? Attractive victims in the sense of, well, and I think about it for my own son. I'm like, he can't really express if something happened to him, mm-hmm. if someone did something inappropriate to him, he doesn't have the ability to express that, explain that, et cetera. And a parent's worst nightmare is I would never know, and mm-hmm. I would have no way of knowing. And I don't want any parent to experience that. I obviously don't want any individual to experience that. And so in that in-between time, I think about all the people they interact with, and it could be hospital staff. It could be first responders. It could be obviously parents. It could be concerned teachers. There could be so many points in between the incident and the forensic interview part. And what happens there? Number one, I'm convinced they're treated differently than non-disabled people, right? They're non-disabled peers. So they might be set up a non-disabled peer, for instance, a neurotypical peer. They might be set up promptly with an appointment promptly in 2 weeks or 4 weeks or whatever.
Right, well, promptly, now, very relative, right? Because we know, yeah. we know that. Right. Because of lack of access for everybody, especially with mental health providers, that and not because people don't care and don't want to, but just because the need is so great and the providers are so few. Yeah, that time is huge. You're right. Exactly.
So yeah, if you're looking at, okay, now we have to set up this disabled client who's going to require, what do we need for this person? Do we need some kind of interpreter? And is that a traditional interpreter or some kind of autistic interpreter? Like, what do we need and how do we do this? I'm convinced they're not getting the same timely services, right? And a lot of this is, like you said, it's nobody's fault. It's nobody's intention. It's just the way things are practically. Mm-hmm. So now more time is passing, right? And so they might get a different setup even than everybody else. And that might be for the good. That might be for the bad. So different things are occurring. These things aren't being probably managed and accounted for, which is not good, because it could be skewing the individual's stories, perceptions, whatever. But they're not being treated the same. And that's the problem. I mean, that's the crux of all of, the problem with disability is we either can't or won't treat you the same. And it's as a result of your disability. So if you can't understand this interview, you really can't participate in it. And we really can't get your narrative. And so then you just lost that opportunity. You just lost having the choice of, do I want to pursue this or not? You lost even the opportunity to be heard, and understood. That's the big piece. To have people appropriately know, hey, there's an approach I can take with you, given what's going on with you. There's a special training that I attended. There is, a way of phrasing a question. There is a way of approaching a person. There is a way of making or not making eye contact. I mean, there's just so many factors to consider. And all of this needs to be thought about. And so that's, one of my big things, and I'll say it over and over again, is I want to change the way people think about this. I want to change the way people approach it cognitively, just from the level of, okay, I'm going to wipe the slate clean. This situation's different. It's going to require something different from me. And I am competent to deliver that is where I'm at with how do I contribute more to this, the competency piece, making sure people are as competent as possible. And because when we're competent, we perform better too, right? So when we feel we have self-efficacy with a population, oh, I'm used to working with autistic people. I can do this. It's not going to be a breeze, but I know what I'm doing, or I know what to do, or I know who to consult, or I know it's going to be different and I'm going to have to make a lot of adjustments.
Yeah. So I like that you're talking about that awareness piece, because that's half the battle, right? Someone saying, I understand autism well enough to say that, you know, I'm comfortable and competent interviewing someone with autism or whatever the diagnosis might be that the person has, and also understanding that's only part of who they are. So this may impact the interview, but remembering that basic piece of we should approach every interview with every person as if they're an individual, right? So understanding how to work with someone with autism, super important, but still remembering, hey, this is a 12-year-old kid sitting in front of me, or this is a 25-year-old man sitting in front of me. And their diagnosis, of course, impacts their communication, perhaps, you know, the way that they are interpreting the world in such a way. But that doesn't mean that they don't have anything to say, that they can't say it, and that we can't ask questions, like you're saying, in such a way that they could be successful with this process. So it's all those things sort of coming together where it doesn't seem so scary. People have access because individuals, professionals are properly trained. So all those things important.
One of the things that I heard you talk about, Diana, was setting mindset. Like as you're walking into investigations, and I know through our trainings, that's something that we find so critical, is walking in and saying, okay, I do understand that this is going to be different, but oftentimes we don't have to completely reinvent the wheel. So I always talk about best practices first and then make adjustments for the person that's in front of you. So from your frame, Diana, and your work, what are some of those pieces of mindset that you see people really needing to adjust when they're working with folks with disabilities, particularly folks with autism, throughout the investigative process?
One is how the just absolute range and variety of communication. So if this form of communication isn't working for you, we got a whole laundry list of stuff we can try. Let's pull out the phone. Let's pull out the, you know, AC device. Let's call the expert, you know, let's get someone in here who knows more of this piece than I do and does this for a living type of deal. How can we, and a lot of it is just being patient and creative. And, you know, the piece I like to emphasize with my law enforcement group is if there's one thing, literally one, that you remember from all of this, it's please be patient. Can you be a little more patient? Just more patient than maybe you thought you were. Dig deep, find that patience. As a parent, like I've had to find that because I'm not a patient person, but it has opened up a world for me that I would never, you know, trade it, knowing now that with patience and just kind of this, okay, you and I are going to figure this out. We're going to figure out a way that we can talk to each other or not talk. Do you need to write something down? Do you need to draw me a picture? Do you need to, whatever it is, just throw it out there and see if it works. And, you know, let the person guide you. Hey, what works for you? And remember, this individual is trying really, really, really hard. And I think people forget that a lot, especially with autistic individuals. My son, really, his biggest challenge is communication. And sometimes I see frustrated people, you know, in the supermarket or wherever, thinking like, oh, this kid's being bad, or he's not listening or whatever. And I want to say to them, like, I guarantee you, he's trying so, so, so hard to figure out what you want, to figure out what you're trying to say to him, to figure out what you're trying to get him to do. Like he's trying a million times harder than you can even see, because he's the one that's always making the adjustment, right? Now it's your turn as the forensic interviewer and the adult and all the other stuff, the person who's trained, you can make those adjustments. And I know it's stressful because you're also trying to remember the model and ask the right questions and, you know, avoid those close-ended ones and make sure you get in those recall. And I get it. It's hard. You know, I'm a clinician. I've done lots of interviews, but it is necessary. And I, that's why I really think it comes from the shift in mindset and not just the, I'm just going to learn a whole list of skills. I love skills. Trust me, I do. But there's more to it than let's try this checklist of skills. It's like, I gotta throw away that part of my brain that's like watching the clock and worried, oh, we've already been talking for 30 minutes and we haven't gotten anywhere. It's like, well, maybe that's what building rapport with someone different than you looks like. And if it does, great. Who cares how long it took? And now, so you know.
I like all the things you're saying, and they're just make my heart grow three sizes over here. So one of the things that you said, first of all, about patience. So I think that that's an important shift in the mindset. But I really like how you're talking about communication, and it's less about saying that the person, here, write it, here, draw it. It's not, right? It's can you? What do you think about this? Let's figure it out together. So that alignment in so many ways is helpful because you get that partnership, that relationship, that rapport, whatever it looks like. But then there's also this reduction of authority, right? We're not saying like, you have to do this because I said so. You're saying, hey, what you're saying is important to me, and I want to make sure that I listen, and I want to make sure I get it all correct in the best way that you can communicate it. So not assuming that everybody can write or not assuming that everybody can draw. But what we like to say a lot in our trainings too, is that people have a way of getting their needs met. Figure out what those ways are. There has to be a way that they communicate to the people around them. Hey, I'm hungry. I'm thirsty. I don't feel well. So what are those ways that already exist, and how can we, like you're saying, be the ones to make those adaptations and center our expectations for communication around that to make the person, you know, more successful? Because chances are pretty good they want you to know, right?
Right.
You're occasionally going to get somebody that's like, screw you, I'm not talking to you, right? That happens in every population. But for the most part, people want to be understood and they want you to understand their perspective. So giving them the opportunity to do that is important. So it's that creativity, like you said, mixed with the patience, and then having some of those tools in their toolbox to just try new things.
You know, one of the things that we talk about a lot in our trainings is arming yourself with information, coming prepared into an interaction rather than just showing up blind. And I often talk about how when I was a brand new baby forensic interviewer like a decade ago, I would walk into a room basically just knowing 15-year-old sexual abuse by grandpa. Even for typically developing individuals, I would have very little information. And that process, even for typically developing individuals, has molded and changed over time, where I walk in with a lot more information because I know it doesn't make me a non-neutral professional anymore. So we talk about this a lot in our trainings about, okay, arm yourself with information about this person specifically. Yes, learning about disabilities and having understandings of characteristics, super important. But also we need to frame it in the mind space of, okay, what can this individual do? What are their strengths? Maybe where do some of their deficits lie so that you can help tailor that process. And when you walk into the interaction, you're like, all right, I understand from all of these different people in their life that these are the tools that I have in my toolbox so that I can see what's happening on the day of the forensic interview and say, okay, here's the things that I'm going to try. Because even though we're told all these sorts of things before the interview, sometimes that's not the way that it goes when it happens in front of us. So we talk about arming yourselves with information, but being ready to check it out the window based off of what's happening in front of you, and being flexible and present in that moment, even if you're the person who has done, you know, three other interviews that day, where you're like, okay, I'm just going through this protocol over and over again. We have to practice mindfulness and being present in every single interaction. And it's something that I think is hard when we have something that's a little bit more routinized for what we do, but it's something that we consciously have to fight so that we're giving each person that we're working with the best possible services.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And this is such a hard thing to teach students, and I think beginners, because they want to hear there is a recipe, there is a formula, and as long as you stick to it and you check off these check boxes, you won't fuck up. That's all they care about. But it just doesn't work that way in the real world. I've had a lot of students complain, wow, Dr. Oram, this is really not so black and white, especially in deception detection. I'm like, did you come to this class thinking I was going to teach you, like, here's the magic trick for telling when people are lying? You just watch how many times they blink. You know, you watch how many times they fidget. And then you see if they make eye contact. And then you know, by the way, I use those because those are so many things that neurodivergent people do naturally that everybody thinks means you're lying. So the students get frustrated, I guess, understandably so, because they came in with the mindset of, I'm just going to learn a, you know, a checkbox style, blueprint style. And if I just do it, you know, I will be successful. And you won't. So it doesn't work that way. And if you're that uncomfortable with this, maybe this is not the job for you. This is not the component of the job for you. You're not the one in the room asking the questions, perhaps, because this is just not in your comfort zone. But if it is, you are the type of person who can adapt, change on the fly, be self-aware, stay in the present moment. It's a huge, like, I'm not trying to make it sound easy. There are so many demands here. And then we're adding on to it, like, learn all the disability stuff also. And it isn't easy, but for the people that are good at it, like, you will make the type of difference in someone's life that you just can't even put into words. So it's right. Worth it.
It's one of those challenging pathways for us as forensic interviewers, going from new interviewer of first I do this, then I do this, then I do this, then I do this, to like adding in and layering in those critical thinking skills. Because a lot of what we're doing is making decisions in the moment based off of the things that are happening. And there's a lot of things that are affecting those decisions, maybe consciously or unconsciously, along the way. And so all of that plays into how we think and how we act and how we ask questions through that interview process. And that's the tricky thing for us to teach in forensic interviewing. You know, we can point out lots of different things, you know, to interviewers along the way. But having that person be like, all right, like, I'm going from first I do this, then I do this, then I do this, then I do this, to being that, like, you know, well-versed person who's able to apply those critical thinking skills is a tricky pathway for people. And one that I think, you know, as we grow as a field, you know, I think we'll find better and better ways to support people in that. But certainly, you know, that's why we in our trainings think about, okay, what are the things that would be helpful for you to know so that you are able to make those informed decisions throughout the interviews that you're doing with folks with disabilities? So it kind of takes it from that first you do this, then you do this, then you do this. And then you think about, okay, what's the best thing for me to do based off of what's presenting in front of me in the moment?
And it's why we struggle so much. Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Go ahead, Diana.
Oh, I was going to say, even that term right there, what is the best thing I could do right now? Not the right thing, just the best thing. You know, that's the best we can do. That's the best we get. You know, and feeling that sense of, I think I did the best thing.
So, and that's exactly why in training, some people are like, well, I just want to watch a video of you interviewing somebody with autism. And we say, that's not going to be helpful to you, because that will only teach you how to interview that person, right? And you're probably not going to interview that person, because I already did. So, yep. You know, you need to be thinking about those critical thinking moments of, okay, could I apply these skills? But people are like, I just want to see you do it and then I could do it. It's like, well, that may be true, but also I want to teach you how to think through those moments, just like Kate's saying. So in that situation, what would be your best shot? And if that doesn't work, what would be your plan B? And what would you do after? Because like Kate said, also, we have those best laid plans. Sometimes we do the homework, we do the research, we talk with speech pathologists, you know, we talk with occupational therapists, whoever we can talk to that's willing to share some of their knowledge with us. But sometimes those plans go right out the window. I had a case like that recently where I was all set to go. I had the questions to ask her in order to, you know, validate her communication, make sure we were understanding each other. And then every single time I asked her a yes, no question, because she didn't speak. So that was one of my options, right? She said yes to every yes, no question I asked her, regardless of what it was, even if I knew and I knew that she knew that the answer was no. So I was like, ooh, reliability becomes an issue here. I need to pivot very quickly in my conversation. So having the skills to be able to say, whoop, that's not going to work. What else have I got potentially that I can work with here? And teaching people how to critically think is definitely a harder thing than then to just say check box A and then box B and box C and move all the way through. So How do you think, Diana, that we could maybe help people with some of that critical thinking and that open-mindedness that we're talking about?
So speaking of what, can I just watch you do this for 45 minutes and I'll know how to do it? I'll just mimic you and do what you do.
Right.
My next thought, or, you know, my idea that I'd like to pursue here in the research realm is we have video now. I was just reading, I can't even remember, it was published 25 years ago. It was one of these, you know, taboo expert witness forensic interviewing chapters. And they were going on and on about how, well, because we'll never be able to see what actually happened in the interview, and then you're testifying. And I'm like, everything's changed. So we can have everything on video. We can have everything recorded. For better or worse, that's what we have. So I'm thinking we have all of this material. We have all of these interviews. Some are purely training. Some are, you know, obviously the real deal. Some are somewhere in between. With these videos, the thing that I think could be useful is not watching them, although I'm sure there's value in that, so I'm not knocking that, but instead turning these training videos into opportunities to get people to think differently by stopping at critical points in a video. So let's say within the first 60 seconds of a video, you see an interviewer and I'm interviewing you and you're sitting there not looking me in the eye. And I start doing, you know, a subtle kind of thing to try to get you to look me in my eye, right? And that's a pretty neurotypical thing to do. I want this person to make eye contact with me because I want to connect to her. I want us to have a connection. I want to build rapport with her. I want to make sure she knows that I care. So that's my intention, right? So I would pause that video at 60 seconds and say, okay, what was going on there? You could have questions pop up on a computer screen. And, you know, you could have the person make their best judgment. Basically, they're making an attribution at this point, a cognitive attribution. And they're sort of saying, okay, that interviewer was trying to establish eye contact and rapport. Or it could go the other way. That interviewee was disinterested and uncooperative. That interviewee was lying. That interviewee was, you know, being evasive. That interviewee has something to hide. And that's why they weren't making eye contact. And so these are probably errors. These are most likely mistakes. So my thought is, if we can catch them in the here and now and correct them, because by correcting, I just mean introducing alternative explanations. I'm really talking about, you know, CBT in a sense, cognitive behavioral therapy, changing the way you think. So instead of jumping to the conclusion of, hey, kid, like, what's your deal? Just look at my eyes, you know, like, what's your problem? You're making this suck for me. I can't follow the steps until you look me in the eye. Throw that out the window. And we can go with, hey, maybe this person is autistic. Maybe this person's neurodivergent. Maybe the eye contact is way too intense when they meet new people. Maybe it's way too bright in this room. So there are so many alternative explanations. And if we could just get people thinking that early in the game, like, whoa, so many alternative explanations, then they will make different decisions. And so when you see an expert do what they do and you ask them, how did you know to do that? They usually can't explain because it's that expert thing, right? I don't know. I've worked with this population long enough. I knew what they were doing. I knew they didn't want to make eye contact. So I just sat parallel to them and let them do their thing until they were comfortable. What? And it's like, okay, but where did you learn that? And how did you know to do that? That is the decision-making process, right? That when you're talking about critical thinking, that we want to embed into people's heads, and then they don't need someone to constantly be there being like, remember, autistic people do this weird thing. They don't need that anymore because now it's a part of them. I reprogram them. That's my goal. So I'm trying to reprogram people so that they can meet autistic people halfway. Neurodivergent people. And I think that if I can get this off the ground and get this thing going and set it up in a way that it's easy to do and it's immersive enough and all this other kind of stuff, it's pretty basic when you think about it. You go through, you find the critical errors or decision points, and then you give people an option they didn't have in the moment. Right?
Or didn't think they had. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you show them, obviously good examples, bad examples, feedback is immediate. Sometimes feedback is, and a lot of the feedback is not even about the person, right? It's about the interaction that they're watching. So it takes away that feeling of, oh, I'm on the hot seat. I'm going to be criticized for not knowing how to work with this population. No, you're not. We acknowledge that it's hard. That's why we've developed these unusual techniques, because this is not, you know, your everyday interview. Like, there is an everyday interview. There's not. And like you said earlier, everybody's unique. And I'll quote Stephen Shore, once you've met one autistic person, you've met one autistic person. So
we use that quote in our trainings too, all the time, because it's just something that's important to remember. And I think you could apply it to any population. If you've met one 35-year-old, you've met one 35-year-old. If you've met one 86-year-old, you've met one 86-year-old, right? So taking those, that mindset, that rewiring, the whatever, you know, we need to do to get people's mindsets in a place where they can be open, creative, have that critical thinking. It's really, really important with every population. But I think that we could do a lot of great work with this population, with the skills that you're talking about, the way that you're talking about doing it, that, oh, what, you know, sort of what would you do, right? Would you do this? Or would you do this? Or would you do something different? And I think that those are the critical thinking muscles that people need some help with. And training like that, I think, could really, really help people a lot. So that's exciting. It's exciting. A lot of good stuff happening. What we like to hear. Very cool. Kate, any final questions for Diana?
So Diana, I know you talked a little bit about your trainings and what you do with that, but are there any other projects that you're currently working on that you want to share?
So one of the projects that I'm working on is somewhat similar, but I'm getting body-worn camera footage, which I'm sure you guys know what that is, from law enforcement when they've got their cameras on and they tape an interaction. So I'm getting body-worn camera footage because I want to do the same thing. I want to break down those incidents, and we have some, it hurts me to say this, we have some really good ones on tape in that they're bad, the incidents themselves, but the amount of information we have is great. And so I've been using these in my trainings much more informally. And that means me pressing pause, you know, and being like, hey guys, what just happened? What do you think they should do next? All right, unpause. There's a much more sophisticated way to do this. And that's what I want to develop. So with the body-worn camera footage, you can code different types of interactions, right? Positive, negative. I mean, there's a million ways you can code stuff. But what I'm interested in is coding for these typical mistakes that are made with this population. One of those is the assumption they're intoxicated. That's an easy place to start. When you see an interaction and it starts to go south, it's almost always because the law enforcement officer is convinced this person's drunk.
And because that's something they're trained to look for, right? So exactly. They're trained to look for that. So, yeah.
Yep.
They know and what they it are. Looks like.
Yep. Mm-hmm. They're not only trained to look at that, they're not trained to discriminate. I've read all their training materials, the drug recognition expert stuff. And well, it has, man, and I teach a course on drugs. So I'm like, you guys really covered it. You got way into it. With PCP and angel dust, great. But you never stop to mention, sometimes if people seem high, it's because they have a medical condition or something going on, a neurodevelopmental condition. There's a million different explanations for that potential behavior. But if you're only trained to look at it through the lens of this person's intoxicated, then that's all you're going to see. And again, that's not your fault. Someone put the cognitive blinders on you, and I want to take them off. And so when we watch these incidents, again, more informally, just hitting the pause button, I get tons of feedback from the audience saying, oh no, he's going to field sobriety test him. He thinks he's drunk. Oh no. They can see it, you know, because they're watching in slow-mo and they're not in the moment. And then we watch in horror as the whole thing kind of just deteriorates from there. And then we go into, you know, look, everybody who wasn't there, you know, we don't know, but if we were and we had a perfect world and we could just change it up, what would we do differently? What would you do differently? How would you approach us differently knowing what you know now? How could this have gone better? And people, that has been the single most useful part of my training, in my opinion. People love this. I give them an even longer activity where they read a transcript of a true incident. They read it together. They play the parts. And man, like I listen to their conversations and they're like, holy shit, this cop is about to tase this kid. Oh my God, he really did it. Why? You know? And it's like, yeah, that's what you watch after the fact when you slow it down. But we even look at things like, what was the time between the police officer approaching and this person speaking? 11 seconds. For an autistic person, that's for anybody, that's not enough time, you know, to understand and get what's going on here. So we really break it down. And people seem to be very receptive to that. They're getting a lot out of it, which is why I want to move into this, you know, breaking down body-worn camera footage, breaking down forensic interviewing footage, and just building this all in, because I think it will be useful.
And once people have the information, hopefully we see that different approach. Hopefully we see, you know, once we know what to look for, it's a lot easier to see it. But, you know, and I say this all the time, I think I've said it on our podcast before, I say it in training, police have to be good at so many things, right? Yeah. They have to be good at so much stuff. And sometimes it's hard to be like, oh, by the way, you have to learn something new. But when we look at the negative ramifications of not, you know, including this in what we're teaching first responders, we can see, you know, the negative outcomes for everybody that's involved. And those are the things that we want to reduce, because we don't want, you know, police to be out there having misunderstandings with people with disabilities. And for the most part, I don't think police want that either. Right? I think they would say the same thing. Yeah, they're definitely motivated to do their job well. And I think that that's something that we have to always be remembering. We have to ask them to do a lot of stuff. They're making very critical decisions in the moment when there's lots of stuff going on and everyone's looking to them to make those decisions in the middle of a crisis. Sometimes it's hard for people to, you know, think about all the things they've ever learned in that time. So immediate safety, of course, becomes critical of everybody. And sometimes that looks a little different. But as things escalate, we know that sometimes folks with different diagnoses respond in different ways. And so understanding that is also important. So it's, you know, there's a little part of me that's like, ooh, I feel terrible because we're asking first responders to do more things and they already have so many things to do. But I do think, like I said, that they'll be happy to have this added to their knowledge base. So they're not just looking for someone being under the influence, right? There could be so many other things going on. And once they're equipped with that information, usually that's where we see those better outcomes. So I think it sounds great. And I'm excited to see what you come up with.
So am I. And I do want to give a shout out, because so far I've had just an absolutely great reception from them. They've been, and again, I'm in a rural county in Arizona. Most people haven't heard of Prescott. If you've heard of maybe Sedona and Flagstaff, that's around here as well. But I've had just positive 100%. Everybody's been amazing. I've had so many people come up to me and say, my son is autistic, or my nephew, or, you know, I regularly encounter this autistic person in the course of my job, and I always wondered what to do, and now I know, and I feel so much better, and what else can I do? Like, I've just been very impressed. People told me it was going to be an uphill battle, and I did not believe them, because I was like, who doesn't want to know what to do, you know, at work? Like, most normal humans are like, yeah, like, I want to know how to do my job.
Right. I want to do my job well.
Yeah. Especially when the stakes are high. So I'm like, no, these guys are going to want to learn this stuff. And ladies, and they have. So I just appreciate their willingness to come in and sit with me for 4 hours and do this training with me and indulge me and read my transcripts and play along with my little, you know, let's figure out what we should have done differently game, because I'm going to turn that into something, and I'm excited to see where it goes next. So I'm giving a shout out to my county, to Yavapai County Sheriff's Office, and everybody else in Prescott and Prescott Valley.
I think that's awesome. That's wonderful. And hopefully they listen and hear that shout out from you. And hopefully they already know how awesome they are because you're working with them, but hopefully they will even more so know how awesome they are. Awesome. All right. Well, thank you so much for spending this time with us and letting us hear about your projects and your thoughts and the great things that are going on in your county, not only for law enforcement and the trainings you're doing, but of course, in your role at the university as well. So really excited for what's coming up. And hopefully we'll continue to stay in touch and hear more about your projects on a future episode.
Yeah, I would love that. And thank you so much again for inviting me.
Thanks for listening. For more information about the work being done by Modell Consulting Group, visit our website, modellconsultinggroup.com, or follow us on social media.